to get started because there's quite a lot to get through in this session on Corbyn, Brexit and the British Labour Party today. So, my name's Simone and I'm going to be chairing this session. I'm from the Sydney branch of Socialist Alternative and I would like to introduce our speaker, who is Sean Harkin. Sean has been a socialist for a long time. He is in the Socialist Worker Network in Ireland. He's one of our special guests, international guests from Ireland, and is also a member of People Before Profit in Ireland, and actually stood for election for People Before Profit last year. So Sean's going to kick off the discussion, and as per usual, at the end of the discussion, we'll actually have time for questions and some input from you guys. And there is a lot to get through, so make sure to jot things down if you want to raise them in the discussion at the end. For now, I'll hand over to Sean.
Thanks, comrade. can you hear me okay? Is that all right? I don't know if I'm into the mic. Okay, I think today is both Easter Sunday, is that correct? Because the jet lag is really messing with me, and it's also April Fool's Day. So, as far as I know, Christ hasn't been resurrected, but the British Labour Party has been resurrected by Jeremy Corbyn. Hope I didn't offend anybody with that. Simone mentioned I stood for election. So technically, I actually stood against Corbyn, well, against him and with him, because in the north of Ireland, in the Westminster elections in 2017, we also get to stand because we're part of the United Kingdom. And our pledge was that if we get elected, which we unfortunately didn't, we would go and vote with Jeremy Corbyn and take a stand with him to fight for people's Brexit. So today, even though it is April Fool's Day, a comrade shared the Sunday Times front page, and it's shocking. I don't know if people have seen it. There's no reason that you would. But the headline today is Jeremy Corbyn's Factory of Terror. And there's a picture of Jeremy Corbyn. If you go to The Guardian, which people sometimes see as a more left-wing newspaper, the headline is Charges of Anti-Semitism Against Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. And there has been a relentless onslaught of attacks now on Corbyn about anti-Semitism. And I think that these are entirely manufactured in order to slow down Corbyn's momentum, in order to discredit Corbyn, to discredit the Labour Party, and to try to bring the Labour Party and Corbyn in line with the foreign policy of the British Conservative Party and the British ruling class. So I was delighted today to see a statement from Corbyn condemning the murder and the massacre that was carried out in Gaza on Friday. And I think it's a very important thing that he has done that. Very few leaders of mass parties around the world have actually taken that step. So it's great to see Corbyn actually doing it. And Corbyn, as people probably know, has been a long-standing member of the Palestine Solidarity Movement in Britain, an active member of it, not just a passive member. He's been a leader of the Stop the War Coalition in Britain. So these accusations, and all his life, Corbyn has campaigned against racism. I mean, there might be some elements of racism or anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, but it's certainly not Jeremy Corbyn himself. And I'm sure he would take all measures to stamp out any manifestation of anti-Semitism or racism or Islamophobia. I think the people who've been organising this onslaught, their problem with Corbyn is his support for Palestine and his opposition to US and UK imperialism. So they want to argue, as we know, that if you're anti-Zionist, you're also you're an anti-Semite, and that's the logic of the argument. And Corbyn, through the last 30, 40 years of his political activism, has stood against this. Even when it's been, even when the pressure has actually mounted. So it's great to see him condemning the violence against Palestinians. It's also, I mean, this has been something that the right wing of the Labour Party has been relentless in pushing as well. And that's ironic at this time too, because we're 15 years on since the Iraq War, which Tony Blair and his hatchet men brought the UK in on the basis of a number of lies that led to a million dead Iraqis, a destroyed Iraq, and has actually set the stage for the increase in violence that we've seen across the Middle East over the last 10 to 15 years. And it was Jeremy Corbyn and others who actually campaigned against that war against the lies that the Blair administration put forward. So these people are constantly trying to whip up, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is, I mean, he's been a sympathiser of Sinn Féin. He's a supporter of United Ireland. So that makes him a terrorist sympathiser. And this is the sort of stuff you see constantly, not just in the right-wing press, but also in elements of the kind of more liberal press as well. So Corbyn's election, the leadership of the Labour Party, I think came as a surprise to many people. I was certainly surprised about it because I had essentially, along with many others, written off all possibilities for the Labour Party. It had been so transformed by Blair into a neoliberal machine. It had demoralised people. It had taken so many, it had pushed through so many anti-working class measures, signed up for George Bush's war. I mean, could this party really be saved? It looked unlikely. Thousands of people, tens of thousands of people had left the Labour Party because of that. And people had tried since, you know, the early 2000s to begin to construct an alternative party of the left that could grow. So it was a big, big surprise that when Corbyn stood for leadership of the Labour Party that he actually won it. But what's happened because Corbyn stood is that it's absolutely transformed the political landscape in Britain, and it's raised people's sights, it's raised people's horizons, and it's raised people's confidence. The change, fundamental change, is possible. And this is obviously not just about Corbyn. Corbyn is the vehicle through which people who are angry at the establishment, angry at decades of austerity, are voting, and it's the way that people are expressing their massive demand for change. So if people think back to 2015, there's been two Westminster elections in recent years. 2015, after a decade of Tory austerity, Ed Miliband ran a basically Tory-light election campaign that got absolutely nowhere, that actually aped the Tories and the right wing on questions like immigration. And it wasn't a big surprise that his campaign didn't win. But what it did do is it reinforced this idea that in Britain everybody was conservative, that people had become apathetic, that the unions were powerless, that young people didn't care, and there was more or less support as well for the policies that the Tories had been carrying out since the crisis. So that was the picture in Britain. And I'm sure if you talk to left-wingers in Britain, you know, they didn't like talking about Britain, and it was all doom and gloom. And, you know, very, very, most people that I spoke to were feeling very, very hopeless. And it wasn't just that, it was that the left was in a crisis. The attempts to construct a different kind of party hadn't gone very well. So Corbyn's rise really has transformed that whole situation. So when he actually stood for leadership, he got something like 60% of the vote. And I think people were absolutely stunned. And in that election campaign, the media, now there's been an academic study that said 75% of newspapers distort everything that Corbyn puts out, every message. So we just can't rely on the corporate media. We know that already. But it's been systematic. And when you think about his success in the face of that, it's all the more amazing that his the political arguments have been able to break through. So he won the leadership of the party, much to the shock and horror of the Labour right and the Blairites. And I think that meant that grassroots activists in the Labour Party, when they had the opportunity, were desperate to see an alternative strategy. That people believed if we actually put out a set of arguments that appeal to people that are socialist, we can actually make some headway. So then the next thing that happened then, and this is somewhat chronological, it helped me to write the talk because it's a broad subject, was the European Union referendum, which was in June 2016. And again, The referendum, if people remember it, this was about the Conservative Party who wanted the leadership of the Conservative Party who wanted to remain in Europe, believed that they would have an easy victory against the right, and they were attempting to outflank parties like UKIP and people like Nigel Farage. And so there was a very divisive campaign over the European Union. In the left in Ireland, we actually campaigned to leave ourselves, even though that was a very, very unpopular argument at the time. And the arguments play out quite differently in Ireland in terms of its relationship to the European Union than they do somewhat in Britain. And of course, there was a number of different arguments about why a majority of people decided to leave the European Union in Britain. At first, it was basically accepted that it was entirely racist. I think as people did more analysis and looked at the regions that had voted out and the reasons why people had voted out, there was, of course, racism, but this was just as much people trying to stick it to the establishment, the political parties that for a decade had delivered austerity and then come along and said, you should stay in the EU because this is what gives us our prosperity. Of course, people were going to reject that, and large numbers did. They decided that they didn't want to take the advice of people like David Cameron and George Osborne, and the fact that the vast majority of multinationals and British corporations all backstay in the European Union. So there was a lot of fallout, obviously, from that vote. That was another shock to the political system. So we had Corbyn winning the leadership of the Labour Party. Then we had an EU election, or an EU referendum, that didn't go the way the entire establishment and pundits all thought it was going to go. I think it spoke to the fact that like something fundamental was happening in terms of people's opinions, that there was no longer a way of easily measuring what people would vote for or do. Now, what happened then, Corbyn was in the Remain camp. He actually took a vacation or a holiday during the referendum. And I don't really think his heart was in it in terms of campaigning for Remain. All his life, like many others, or through his political years of political activism, he'd always been for leaving the European Union. He'd been against entry. He'd campaigned against the various treaties. And because of what he and others on the British left thought that the European Union represented, which was a bosses' club, which put the interests of big capital, banks, before the vast majority of people, not just in Britain, but across Europe. And it was for all those reasons that I think that he was a reluctant campaigner to stay in the European Union. So what happened then was that after that vote, the Labour right blamed Corbyn for the EU, for the referendum. And they went viciously after him once again. This kind of idealist nonsense that was going to destroy the British economy, where working class living standards were going to plummet. And this was just this crazy, out-of-touch, left-wing nonsense of the 1970s that Corbyn represented. And they actually forced a leadership fight, another leadership fight, for the Labour Party. And what happened? Corbyn, instead of losing that fight, actually got a bigger mandate. He got a bigger percentage of votes. He went into the 60s, 60% plus. And again, this was the third major upset, in a sense, in terms of the people not voting the right way from the point of view of the establishment. And I think that people began to grasp then that something fundamental was happening, that there was a bubbling from below in terms of people's what people were willing to support. And it was obvious in a lot of ways, if you've been hammering people for a decade and more with cuts to public services, wages going down, pay freezes, fees for students, of course there's eventually going to be a reaction, even if it's somewhat delayed. Or in the case of the Labour Party, if people see that as their vehicle to express their opposition or desire for a fight, and that party's not capable or willing to lead that fight, that can actually delay the ability for it to express itself. So out of the EU referendum, there was a massive crisis for the British establishment. The Tory party, which was majority Remain, now had to lead Brexit negotiations to get out of the EU And you had the British ruling class corporations saying, we don't want to go along with any of this. So it was a disastrous situation for the Tories to be in. And that forced a leadership change inside the Tory party as well, where David Cameron basically walked off and George Osborne walked off as well. And there was a leadership fight, a very vicious leadership fight. And it was like, you know, the early 1990s, there was some vicious leadership fights. When Thatcher finally departed, this was just as bad. Where like allies would knife each other in the middle of the night. And the headlines would be, you know, from day to one day to the next, the various alliances with the Tory party would change. And so we ended up through that process with Theresa May, a Remainer, who was going to lead the exit negotiations for Britain out of the EU. Now, Cameron and Osborne had kind of played, they had thrown the dice with the Scottish referendum as well. Now, from the point of view of the British ruling class, you know, 300 years of empire or longer, still one of the strongest economies in the world, one of the wealthiest societies in the world, one of the biggest and most important militaries in the world, both the Scottish referendum and the EU, I think, threatened their arrangements and the kind of order that they are, the kind of global order that they're part of. If people think back to the Scottish referendum, again, that was written off as a kind of hopeless case, but it came very, very, very close. And what would that have meant? That would have meant that the United Kingdom, as we know it, would have broken up. They would have lost Scotland. And I think that that would have been very demoralising for the British ruling class and made it more difficult for them to intervene in the world with their military escapades and would have, heralded, I think, a huge crisis. It also, if Scotland had voted to leave, it would have raised the prospect of possibly a campaign in Ireland for United Ireland, and then obviously the issue of Wales as well. But they were willing to kind of take the risk, and they got off. They got off with that one, and they didn't get off with the EU one. So this created a huge crisis for the leading party of Britain. And really, the Brexit vote really shocked the political establishment. So where does that leave us? So because May was the new Prime Minister, because there was a civil war happening in the Tory party, because the establishment felt like things are getting out of control, she decided to call for an election on June 8th, 2017, just last year. Now, I think that she believed and the Tory party believed, as bad as the crisis is for us, it looks a lot worse for the Labour Party, because in the Labour Party, the right wing of the Labour Party are actively trying to destroy Jeremy Corbyn. They want to bring him down again. They were trying to force a third election, a third leadership fight. So the prospects for the Tories were, they were riding high in the polls. The Corbyn's polls were shockingly low, probably the worst in decades. And so this seemed like the perfect time for Theresa May to call for an election, only 7 weeks' notice. And that's what the political picture was. And then the election itself, the Blairites went, the Blairites were basically operating as a wing of the Tory party, telling people, if Corbyn's not for opposing a hard Brexit, if he's not calling to stay in the European Union, you should vote anybody that's for Remain. So don't vote for Corbyn in this fight. And again, I think that like the way the media presented it was that Corbyn represents a set of left-wing ideas that no one is interested in. There's no public support for these arguments, and there's going to be an absolute annihilation of the left or of the Labour Party. It's going to set it back decades. It might actually mean it becomes less of a force in British society. I think people on the left as well were somewhat shaped by this. How could you not be when it's like relentless propaganda saying that you've absolutely no chance? So that led us into the election then. I should mention that that leads us into the June 8th election. Corbyn basically campaigns on a socialist platform. He produces a red book, and that spreads like wildfire. And the content of it is, I'm not going to assume people know what the content was of the programme that Corbyn put forward, but it was the most left-wing set of demands that the Labour Party had put forward in a long, long time. It called for the abolition of student fees. It said that they said that they would raise the minimum wage to £10. It called for the reversal of privatisation, which both the Tories and the Labour Party pushed very, very far. It said that they would renationalise the railways, a very popular thing to do. You probably see people complaining about waiting for trains in Britain and overcrowded trains, and they're very expensive. Renationalising the postal service, ending austerity, and beginning to fund properly public services like the National Health Service, which people hold very, very dear across Britain. And Corbyn promised that they would actually raise taxes on corporations, that they would raise taxes on the super rich, that he would block and end fracking. And so these were the type of demands that caught the imagination of millions of people all across Britain. So despite the relentless campaign by the mainstream media, by the Tories to dismiss Corbyn, and by a section of the Labour Party to undermine the Labour Party's efforts, the Labour Party ended up in the June 8th election with its best showing since 1945, with the greatest share of the popular vote in decades. And this was an entirely transformational event all of a sudden Britain went from this right-wing country with very conservative values, where everybody was atomised, neoliberalism had successfully individualised everybody, where unions didn't matter anymore, where workers were unwilling to fight back and stand up for themselves, to all of a sudden, even though Theresa May and the Tories had won the election, the actual victor in the election was Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party, and socialism. And what it demonstrated was that socialism was tremendously popular. And obviously, the media played up the youthfulness of Corbyn's campaign, and many young people did come out and back his campaign. Huge numbers of young people voted for Corbyn. But it wasn't just young people, it was the working classes who'd been hammered by Tory austerity for the previous decade. And this was just the latest shock to the political establishment across Britain, where the pundits once again got it completely wrong, because they thought that it's going to be a disaster for Labour and Corbyn is going to be forced out in a quick leadership election. And this election will set up Theresa May to have the authority to negotiate whatever she wants to negotiate with the European Union. It'll also discipline the hard Brexit people who are in the Tory party. And it'll give some comfort to the British ruling class who want the Remainers to be in charge of the EU exit. So none of that came to pass. The Tories had completely messed this up. It was brilliant. We had went from Trump winning to the shock around Brexit, and now this was something that was absolutely fantastic. And the Tory party now, they had lost their overall majority in the British Parliament. So what happened? They had to now turn to the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party. We deal with this party all the time. I don't know if people are familiar with it. Now, this is a party that insists that the north of Ireland is British. We are British. We'll always be British. There'll never be a united Ireland. In every election in the north of Ireland, the issue for the DUP is always the border. Don't vote for any. You have to vote for us if you want to protect the union with Britain. Now, they are British in everything, or the only thing that. Any laws or rights that apply in Britain, they don't want them applied in the north of Ireland. So if you're for a women's right to choose, the DUP have a veto on it, right? If you are for same-sex marriage equality, the DUP don't want to see that in Ireland. They have an open relationship with loyalist paramilitaries, where they, in order, when the loyalist paramilitaries get out to vote for them, they will turn a blind eye to the loyalist paramilitaries who basically terrorise their own working class communities, who profit from drug dealing, racketeering, beating people up who in working class Protestant areas, who step out of line. So this is the DUP, science denying, Irish language hating. This is the DUP are a bunch of bigots. The leadership. So now the Tory party is now reliant on their 10 elected MPs to get anything it wants to do passed in the House of Commons. But it wasn't. So they also did a deal with the DUP where they awarded the DUP for this unholy alliance £1 billion. Now the Tories had said there is no money, right? When trade unions came asking for funding for public services like the NHS, the Tory response was always, "Do you think that there's a magic money tree out in the backyard that we can just go and shake? We don't have any money in the coffers." And all of a sudden, Theresa May was able to reach down the back of the sofa, find £1 billion for the DUP. And people were absolutely outraged about this because people said in Scotland, we don't mind the north of Ireland getting more money because they need it. But why can't we get more money in Scotland? Why can't we get more money in Wales? Why can't we get more money regionally to actually fund our social services and our infrastructure as well? So there was absolute disgust with the Tories for doing this money deal with the DUP, never mind their social conservatism, which also was outraged a lot of people and frustrated people as well. And there's a lot of terrible things you could say about the Tory party. There's a lot of awful people in the Tory party, but they're nowhere near as right wing as the DUP. So this was the election had created this new big problem for the DUP or for the Tories. Now at the time, the Northern Ireland Assembly, which is the product of the Good Friday Agreement, it's the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement now, also called the Belfast Agreement. Now that was an agreement that essentially ended the troubles in the north of Ireland. So the IRA ended its armed struggle against British rule and agreed to a peace process that has been ongoing for the last 20 years. And it created a couple of different institutions. One institution was called the Northern Ireland Assembly, and it devolved government for the north of Ireland and also a power-sharing Northern Ireland executive. Now, this assembly had collapsed in the previous January. And why did it collapse? Well, because the DUP, the new allies now of the Tory party, had been found running a complete and utter racket, costing hundreds of millions of pounds to the taxpayers in the north of Ireland. Now, they would cry poverty themselves. There's no, the DUP would, when it came to demands for funding public services in the north. And then all of a sudden, they were found to be running this scheme. Now, the scheme was called, the Renewable Heating Incentive Scheme. And the idea was that we would get, primarily businesses to switch over to burning, non-fossil fuel type sustainable energy, to use sustainable energy sources, and that there was an incentive program to get them into this. Now, when this went to the DUP, because it went from Britain, they actually turned it into a racket. And what they did is, it was called Ash for Cash, or Cash for Ash. So you would sign up for this pellet burning program, you would buy your burner, and then you would get as many pellets as you could and burn them. For every pound's worth of pellets that you could burn, you'd be given basically £2 back. So all the DUP's business friends thought that this was absolutely amazing. So they signed up for this sustainable energy program, and they were making hand over fist until whistleblowers actually brought it to the attention. So the DUP, out of this crisis, had actually been responsible for bringing down government in the north of Ireland, and many people see that as a threat to the Good Friday Agreement because it's still down. There's no government now in the north of Ireland, and this is the allies of the Tory party. So from the Tory party's point of view, this was not a good setup, and it just went from bad to worse. Everything that they thought was possible it turned to mud. And so that's the state of the arrangement as well. So I've kind of went through what was popular about Corbyn's programme. So what has this meant in terms of Britain now? Because the June 8th election, it'll be a full year, and the issues that have dominated in Britain have been the ongoing debates around Brexit, and I'll talk a bit about that. I don't know how closely people follow the ins and outs. It's actually torturous to try and follow them. The main thing is constantly that the Tories are at each other's throats, and that Theresa May makes big promises about standing up to the EU and then concedes. One of them was that we're not giving any money back as a kind of divorce deal, and they ended up then agreeing to £40 billion. And that was another source of frustration from people who have been told by the Tories that there's no money. So Corbyn's success, I think, has changed the mood in Britain. I don't know if people have seen the Glastonbury Festival and stuff last year, or many other music festivals where people just sing Jeremy Corbyn's name. And there's a general celebration that, like, we've kind of stuck it to the establishment. We have somebody leading the party now who seems like an honest person. I mean, Corbyn was elected in the early 80s and has been a backbencher, was essentially a rebel Labour Party member. I'm sure there was difficult times for Corbyn to survive in the Labour Party through the Blair years. Somehow he stuck it out. But he was the politician who most often went against his own party whip, more often than any other politician in the Parliament. So I think people see in Corbyn somebody that's honest, somebody that sticks to his principles, and then the policies that Corbyn has put forward in terms of an economy, ending the economy that's rigged for the powerful and the wealthy, taxing the rich, taxing corporations. All of these things have been tremendously popular, and they managed to break through the kind of media lies. It's also been the case that, like, hundreds of thousands of people have joined the Labour Party. There's been a return to the Labour Party, a whole new generation. I think there's something like 600,000 members now of the Labour Party, compared to 70,000 for the Tory Party. And there's very vibrant chapters now of the Labour Party all over Britain, where there's a lot of activity and a lot of debate. Again, the image that had been conjured up only 2 years previously was that Britain was heading to be a country that was going to be taken over by Nigel Farage and UKIP. And instead, you have this resurgent Labour Party, and it's resurgent on socialist politics and so on. So again, it has completely thrown up into the air all the assumptions that the mainstream media has made. Now, I think that this poses there's a number of questions that are posed, because obviously it's not just all up and away. Because there's going to be for the Labour Party and for Corbyn, they can't just sit on their successes now. They have to figure out how to continue to build. The next election in Britain might not happen until 2022, so that's a long time away. Any number of things could happen that would undermine the good work that Corbyn and others have done. I think one thing, obviously I'm not in Britain, but I think one argument I would have would be, I don't think people should just wait for the next election and for to see it. That's going to be the way that we change society. I think now there's a huge opportunity to build on the mood of hope, the mood of opposition, that the votes for the Labour Party, for Corbyn's own leadership, and then for the Labour Party itself. To take advantage of the fact that the Tory party are in disarray, and they exploit those divisions. And that means actually now not just having an electoral focus, but actually building up activism. So one thing that I think we chatted about here at the conference was the UCU strike, the strike by lecturers and admin staff across Britain. And they're on strike primarily about their pensions. This has been, and it's a strike that escalated from 2 days 1 week, 3 days the following week, 4 days after that, and then 5 days. And they basically forced the university bosses to back down from their original demands. And then they actually rejected the first contract offer, and they're in a situation right now where they're debating whether or not they accept the latest offer. Now, the strike itself, it's the first national strike, if you want to call it that, since Corbyn's been elected, right? And this was a strike that I think it represents everything that should happen as a result of Corbyn doing so well. The picket lines were big. There was a lot of activity from the strikers themselves. There was huge support from students all over Britain. The union itself has actually grown during the strike. It's added membership. More university lecturers and admin staff have joined it, and it had a lot of public support. Now, for a lecturer's strike, I think that's pretty good. It's not the section of the working class that people think of as the most unionised or needing to stand up for themselves. And, of course, we know that this is all part of the kind of neoliberalisation of education and the university. But I think it's a sign of what's possible, that you can have that level of solidarity, that level of militancy, and the strike actually escalate, and then the confidence of the actual strikers themselves to reject an offer and maybe reject a further offer. And obviously students getting involved as well. There's something that has shifted. So I think that this is the kind of activity right now that can lock in the political support that the Labour Party has got, and actually begin to allow people to start transforming things now, because people shouldn't wait. People should seize the opportunity right now to deliver more blows to Theresa May. They begin to say, well, if you've got £40 billion for the European Union, £1 billion for the DUP, we want to see ours for the National Health Service. We want an end to fees. And that's begun to happen. Just last week, the Tory party came up with what they think is a deal for the NHS staff. Now, there's been the Tories have had a pay cap for public employees, public workers, of 1% a year. And they've just last week said that they're going to end that. This is after 7 years. Now, the NHS workers have been demonstrating. They haven't actually went out on strike yet. But the Tories came up with $4.2 billion for a three-year deal. And it looks good on paper, but it's simply nowhere near what the NHS workers deserve. So I would say from that, If the Tories were asked, where did you find this money? Because you've told us again that there is no money. And so there's clearly lots and lots of money, given how wealthy Britain is. So it seems there could be a campaign and a strike movement around that. There's no reason why NHS workers can't organise themselves. They're very popular. Their unions are quite strong. And this is an opportunity now to actually fight for some of the things that was in the Corbyn manifesto. I read today that the teacher unions are actually planning to go on the offensive as well, that they voted to plan strike actions if their wage demands aren't met. So it would be very exciting if there becomes a wave of fight back and organising around the very things that Corbyn's manifesto has raised people's prospects on as well. And I think that this is the key thing. So if Corbyn is elected, I mean, if the Tory party collapse over Brexit negotiations or something else in the next year or two, it becomes a real question of can there be a Corbyn government? Now, I don't think that the attempt to undo Corbyn's popularity is going to end. I think when you look at today's newspapers, they're just going to continue with this attempt to undermine him and undermine the very movement. But if he was elected, it's not going to be plain sailing in terms of implementing his programme. When he starts saying we're going to end privatisation, that is something that whole sections of the British ruling class have made tremendous profits out of. If he starts talking about renationalising the railways and post offices and actually begins the attempt to carry it through, why not renationalise or nationalise other things? Why not drive the profiteering out of the universities? He's also talked about abolishing student fees. This will not be straightforward. This is not just going to happen because people vote for it inside the House of Parliament. We know that the British ruling class will do everything that they can to undermine that kind of government, to sabotage it, to bring it down, to take their money out of Britain and put it elsewhere. We know that the unelected bureaucrats and generals that run Britain will play their part in trying to undermine a Corbyn government as well. It's already been made clear from different from parts of the military brass who said if Corbyn ever gets elected, we will organise a coup. That shouldn't surprise us. I mean, if we look at every upheaval throughout history, if we even look at Syriza, once popular governments who are anti-austerity, who begin to take on the priorities of the capitalist class, once they get elected, they are either forced, the demand is that they're forced to compromise, guns are held to their head. So I wouldn't look at it in the negative way. We have to, the Corbyn will automatically sell out. He hasn't sold out his entire life, right? But if he's in there and he's elected and he still has some of these like Blairites who are doing everything they can to undo a more progressive government. So what Corbyn and that kind of government will need will be mass organisation on the streets. It will require mass mobilisations, people going on strike to demand, both in the private sector and in the public sector, to demand fundamental change. That is going to be the absolute key to winning before there's a Labour government, to actually seeing a Labour government elected. And also, if there is a Labour government, I think that that kind of extra parliamentary activity is going to determine whether or not we can begin to kind of undo the damage that the Tories and the Blairites have done over the previous 20, 30, 40 years, and begin to take Europe or Britain in a different direction. And if that begins to happen, I mean, Corbyn's electoral successes already have had a massive impact. It's had a big, big impact in Ireland. It means that when we have a reference point now for talking about the different demands that Corbyn has put forward, why can't our political parties who are planning to lower the corporate tax rate raise them in the same way that Jeremy Corbyn is? Why can't our parties begin to talk about ending privatisation when you're in the south of Ireland, which is a tax haven for global corporations, where the corporate tax rate is very, very low? Why can't we do the kind of things that Corbyn is doing? We know it's very popular. It's popular in Ireland. It's popular across Britain. It's popular in Scotland. It's popular across Europe. So it's already had a dramatic impact. And I think that it should raise our sights. It should raise our confidence that socialism has become popular, and we should use that popularity to begin to kind of build the type of social movements that are going to be capable of fighting and organising and demanding change. And I'll stop there.